to welcome you to UC Davis. My name is Winston Cole, and right now I'm the Dean of Medical and Clinical Sciences, so I recommend the campus to welcome you to UC Davis. Many of you have been passing by UC Davis on Highway 80, but never been here. Some of you been here, but the campus is quite different. Right now, you are at the sort of the new gateway of the campus, and we are really developing this gateway. You see the Mandavi Center, you see the Mandavi Institute of Food and Wine, and next year you will see a vineyard there, you know, from the freeway all the way in, and so it will be quite a entrance. Now, UC Davis, if you are not familiar with this, is the third largest of the 10 UC campuses in terms of number of students. We have about 30,000 students. But in terms of budgets, we are the second largest, just second to UCLA, bigger than Berkeley because Berkeley doesn't have a medical school. And so it's our plan. We are the second largest, and this is our third year, over $500 million of research funding. I myself is a high energy physicist. In fact, that's we joined Professor Lander in the back, and myself joined the CMS 15 years ago, okay, before the doctoral residency. And but in the last 10 years, I have been doing administration process this has been a really exciting 10 years for us at UC Davis. We first developed the cosmology from nothing, really from zero, from one faculty member to a quite sizable group. And in 5 years, we hired 7 faculty members, the last one being Tony Tyson. And because of his LSFT project, we also started another interdisciplinary initiative partnered with math, statistics, and computer science, allocated another 6 faculty positions. And that is mainly because the LSFT produced a huge amount of data. Like a 2 petabyte of data a year, and we have to have people from other disciplines to help us to data mine. But on heel of our success of the cosmology program, and in the eve of LHC, we started a initiative for HEPTI, and that is the host of UHF for this this workshop. HEPTI stands for High Energy Frontier Theory Initiative, and from that initiative, we have joined us 3 new faculty members: John Turning, Xinjia Chen, and and we're really glad that Marcus just joined us this year. And so this completes our high energy frontier theory initiative. However, in looking back, high energy frontier theory may not be a great name in the sense that right now we're talking about really talking about particle physics, right? Because we not just high energy per se, that we were really lucky to have Bob Svoboda join us, and so we have a real effort in a direct dark matter search, underground search, and so you know, really emphasis is on particle physics, and I'm pretty sure that's the theme of this workshop. And on that respect, for this year, we are again recruiting eight faculty members in high energy or LHC related particle physics faculty member, and another one next year in the area of direct Archimedes research. So it's a really exciting time for UC Davis growing, and I'm really glad to see all of you, many old friends here, some of the old alums, people being students here, people being postdoc here, and I really welcome you, and so I wish you a great conference. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. So just one quick announcement, if you can't get on the Linksys, you can log on to MobileNet using this as the login ID, and this is the password. Okay. One of the two should hopefully work. So I guess we're ready to...
Let me just make a couple of announcements. First of all, some administrative announcements. There's a dinner tonight. If you have not signed up for it, there's still a chance for you to sign up. Just talk to me, but I need to hear from you before lunch, okay, because we need to get the numbers set up for that. And for lunchtime, we don't have anything planned for lunch, so what I would suggest you do, if you don't know your way to the town, find one of the locals. I'm a new local, so I may not be the best local, but there's also John Turning, Sincha Cheng. Why don't you raise your hand if you're a UC Davis local? Find somebody if you don't know where to go for lunch and do that. And the last thing is, I just want to just say what I think we're trying to do here. This is an untried format, and so as an unorganizer of this unexpected workshop, I'm a little nervous about whether this is going to work. So, I'm going to just put the onus on you, because this is only going to work if you all participate. And I just hope everybody keeps in mind it's supposed to be interaction between theorists and experiments. I hope we don't end up just talking to the people that we already know, that there'll be new contacts made, and maybe we'll all go home with some new ideas about something to work on or think about. Okay. So I think our first talk is going to be Matt Strassler. He's going to tell us about hidden valley models.
Okay, but do I need to use the microphone either for your system or for people here? Because generally I project. If a microphone is not needed for recording.
Not for recording.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so let me proceed without that. Well, I want to say first how pleased I am to be here, and how happy I am that this workshop has been organized, especially in the way it's been organized. I think this is great. I also think it's really fantastic what UC Davis has done, and I want to congratulate them for having put together such a powerhouse in this field. And we are seeking, of course, to emulate them as much as possible on the East Coast. Rutgers, Princeton, and the Institute for Advanced Study are trying to join forces and build a program which hopefully will be an East Coast version of what you've managed to do here. Well, wish us luck. I took to heart very much the notion that this should be a workshop, and that we will have discussions about all of these topics in great detail coming up over the next day and a half. And so I thought the best thing to do would be to give an overview. That is to say, a view of what hidden valleys are and what the types of signatures one can come across, that one comes across in these in this rather large class of models. And the point here is not to cover anything particularly well, but to leave us with a lot of things that we can discuss over the next day. And also, I think there are very close relationships between all three of the subjects which are topics here, and so I will also mention some places where there are overlaps and connections, because I think the discussion should not be limited to one topic at a time in a certain way, because there are so many connections. We really want to be focused on the science itself and not divide things up too sharply. The three papers on the Hidden Valley scenario, which I'll mostly talk about, are two papers with Catherine Zurich. The first paper, just sort of laying out the story, and another on Higgs physics, and then a third paper on supersymmetry physics, and there are several papers in preparation floating around that have been talked about a bit, and also Atlas has a note in preparation internally, so there's stuff going on there, and one of the people from that working group is here, so you can ask him. That's Dan Ventura from the University of Washington. Okay, the Hidden Valley scenario. This is not a model, it's a context in which a certain type of physics can arise. It covers a very large class of models. So, and this class has a very, you get a Hidden Valley model with a very simple structure. You take the standard model, you add some additional sector of particles that are not charged under the standard model. Any hidden sector will do, and some communication mechanism between the two. Now that's almost everything. Let me draw a picture of this, and I'll emphasize one more thing that you need to make it really Hidden Valley. So here's a picture that many of you have seen already with energy on the vertical axis and inaccessibility on the horizontal axis. And the idea here is that there's a sector, well, there's our sector here, and there's a new sector over here, which I'll call the Hidden Valley sector, or the V sector for short. And there's some sort of barrier between the two. This barrier might be a weak interaction, or it might be a heavy particle so that you need a lot of energy to get into this sector, or it might actually be a physical separation, five dimensions or something like that. Doesn't matter. The point is that at left we didn't have enough energy to get in there on a regular basis. But when we get to the LHC, the energy will be large enough that we can start to either go through or over this barrier on a regular basis and start producing particles in this sector. Now, normally you would think to yourself, okay, so what? Your producing particles don't carry any charges under the standard model, so they're invisible, so they just give you missing energy. But in fact, if this valley has a floor, if there's some sort of mass gap or ledge or something that stops particles in here from decaying, then there's a chance that they will decay back through this barrier into the standard model. And the rates for this to happen turn out to be on LHC detector timescales. You can actually see this. This is the main point of the Hidden Valley scenario. Now, what kind of models can serve? Well, as a communicator, basically anything neutral. Z primes, Higgs bosons, LHCs, sterile neutrinos, loops of charged particles will do the trick. It's very general. And similarly, if you ask what can be in the hidden sector, the answer is just about anything. Take your favorite quantum field theory from the 1980s, 1990s, from this decade, even 1970s, QCD-like theories, Kuryang-Mills theory, Suzy gauge theories with fixed points that become confined in the infrared, Randallson and Throats would do, duality cascades, Higgs theories with partial Higgs and partial confinement, multi-flavor models with cascading decays. These all will give you some similar signatures. This is the point. Okay, these are not just randomly thrown together. There's a reason to put these together. Okay, so let me again emphasize the essential ingredients. First of all, the two sectors have to be coupled together, and in general that means there's some gauge invariant operator in the standard model sector times some gauge invariant model, gauge invariant operator in the standard model sector times some gauge invariant operator in the V sector. And that operator product might be induced by some particle exchange or some loops of particles. There's various ways you can do that. And the next thing that has to happen to make it interesting is there has to be some sort of multi-particle production in the V sector. This could be from many different sources. It could be from, for example, a cascade of decays. Or it could be from some sort of physics like the parton shower, either in a QCD-like parton shower or a generalization to it in more strongly interacting theories. Or it could be a dual of one of these things, stringy physics in five dimensions, as one would find in ADS-CFT or Randall-Simon. And finally, you need this ledge. You need this gap or ledge down here which prevents all the particles in here from just decaying down to very soft stuff and going off to infinity and disappearing. You have to have something which stops that. And that could be confinement in this sector. It could be a Higgs phenomenon, which is just dual to confinement. It could be the bottom to a Randall-Simon ADS throat, which is also just dual to confinement. Or it could be something more banal, like just explicit masses that arise after supersymmetry breaking. Now, with these ingredients, you get the following. Well, with these ingredients, you'll get certain predictions that I'll come back to in just a second. What makes this difficult? What makes it difficult is there's too many models. So let me talk to you about why we would talk about this in the first place. First of all, why would we be thinking about this scenario? Extra sectors like this, extra hidden sectors, arise all the time in string theory. In fact, when people try to get the standard model, they just get the standard model, they're very excited because most of the time they have lots and lots of other stuff. And they try really hard to get rid of it, but maybe it's just there. These sectors also arise in supersymmetry ranking models and in lots of other cases. Twin Higgs is a nice example of one which actually uses that for the hierarchy problem. Now, the assumption that the hidden sector is inaccessible to us is a theoretical bias. And clearly, this is not a bias which we should take into the LHC era for the purposes of thinking about what to search for at the LHC. These sectors may not be there, or if they're there, they may not be visible, but we better be sure we can find them if they are. Now, the challenge is that the experimental constraints on these sectors, because they don't carry scatter model quantum numbers, are very weak on the whole. I mean, there are some constraints, but on the whole, they're not very strong. We really don't know what's out there. So there's a vast array of possibilities we have to be prepared for. And many of the signals that I'll show today pose new challenges for LHC experiments. And a lot of the models pose challenges for theorists as well. So we really have a lot of work to do to make sure that experimentally we're prepared. The approach that we're using is to find generic predictions. That is to say, what do these large classes of models tend to predict? And we ground our investigations in models that we really can predict, either fully or largely. So we're sure we know what we're talking about. But they have to apply, these conclusions have to apply to many other models for which we don't know how to calculate. And finally, based on this, we want to work with the experimental community to develop strategies so that broad searches can be done. Because again, with so many models, we can't really afford to pick a few and search for them. We have to have broad strategies that can find this physics in many different forms. Now, what are the generic predictions of the hidden valley scenario? First of all, we're going to have new neutral resonances, which could be quite light. Light could be 10 GeV, it could mean 50 GeV, it could mean 200 GeV, but they're going to be new neutral resonances. I don't know how many there will be. There could be one, there could be 10. There could, when these resonances decay, I don't know what they decay to. There's many different possibilities. I can write down lots of models with lots of different options. Pairs of quarks, pairs of leptons, pairs of gluons. One thing that's very common is bottom quarks. Heavy flavor is quite common. I won't describe that here, but we can talk about that in discussion if you want. But there's nothing preventing decays to 3 or 4 standard model particles as well. So a lot of different options. We don't have strong constraints there. We have to think about all of this. When these resonances are produced, they're often produced in a very high energy event, which means they're highly boosted. If they're highly boosted, that means often they will appear as a single jet. And that means the jet substructure is going to be a key observable in this scenario. Another thing about these resonances is because they have to decay through this barrier, they tend to be long-lived. How long-lived? Depends, unfortunately. I don't have a strict prediction. All I can tell you is that it's very easy to get missing energy because these particles are so long-lived they just exit the detector. That's not so interesting. Missing energy comes from everywhere. But what is more interesting is that it is very common that there are lifetimes such that the decays occur in the volume of the detector and we get displaced vertices. And you might get 1 or 2 of those in an event, or you might get 10 in an event, as for reasons I'll just come back to in a second. And they can show up in any part of the detector. Now, this has a couple of different, very immediate implications. First of all, this is great for LHCb. It's a real opportunity for them to discover new physics before anyone else does. If the rates are high enough, the rates are low, LHCb is low in luminosity, they can't do it, as well as lower acceptance. If the energy of these production processes is too low, then it becomes a serious problem for the Atlas and CMS triggering, and that also requires some discussion. Okay, third general prediction, multi-particle production. There's multi-particle production in the hidden sector. That means when it comes back to us, it's going to be many particles at once. It is not uncommon to see 6 quarks in the final state, 10 quarks in the final state, some models 14, 20, I've even seen 40, and those are in models where I can actually make the prediction and be sure I know what I'm talking about. And in models where I'm not exactly sure, I can see, I find 60 is probably reasonable. 60 quarks and leptons coming out in a single event with 3 TeV of energy going sideways. Okay. You're not going to see 60 jets, right? There's obviously going to be a breakdown of any correspondence between the jets you measure and the particles that are underneath it. So we have an analysis problem as well as a reconstruction problem we have to think about. And also, when you have multi-particle production, you often have very large fluctuations event to event. So you have maybe 100 events, and they all look totally different from one another. They're going to all end up in different bins. How do we collect them and discover a signal? Okay, a couple of other predictions that are less generic but very common. The first is, it's very common to have a big effect on Higgs decays. Higgs is very sensitive, as we all know. This is not just Higgs, but other scalars as well. It's very easy to change the way they decay. It's very easy, for example, to have the Higgs decay to 2 particles, which are called X, which are neutral, and the X decays at some displaced distance from the origin. If that distance is too small, it becomes very hard to see For example, if the X decays to two jets, you just have Higgs goes to four jets, or four Bs in particular, and people like Jack and Robert and Dermasek really push this decay mode. It's a very important one. It's very difficult to be LHC unless the decays are displaced far enough that you can actually detect it. And then you start having a discovery mode. I should emphasize this is not unique to Hidden Valley, and indeed when we talked about this in our paper, we also emphasized that other models could do this. And there are some models, Chen, Fox, and Weiner has this in the corner of one of their models, and Carpenter, Kaplan, and Ree emphasize some of the same points that we emphasized a couple months after ours. And the Chen, Fox, and Weiner paper also emphasizes, as would also happen in Hidden Valley, multi-particle decays. Higgs goes to three or four particles, each of which decays to two quarks electrons. And again, you're really talking about some challenges if you're seeing this, unless the decays are displaced, in which case it's an opportunity. Let me just show a quick picture of what that might look like. Here is a decay. Here's the process. Glue goes to Higgs. Higgs mixes with another Higgs in a different sector. It decays to two particles, and those particles decay at some distance to BB bar pairs. The Carpenter-Kaplan-Ree model is very similar, except it's three jets instead of two. And they made some of the very same observations. In particular, this kind of event is very difficult for Atlas and CMS to trigger on. The reconstruction challenge is serious, and there's a real opportunity for LHCb. Also, there's a real opportunity for the Tevatron, which I didn't mention on this slide, but people are looking for, including some people in the room. Here's an event, an LHC scale event, with a displaced vertex here from a BB bar pair, and another one here. That is in your pixel detector. That's not so hard to find. Here's another one with a displaced vertex here and here. By the way, the reason this looks off to the side is because there's some very soft cracks going off in this direction that I've thrown away because they're so soft they won't make it out. This would be a much bigger challenge, even if you had it on tape. And look at how little energy is out here and here. You will not even trigger on this probably at level one, and even if you do at level one, you throw it away. Yeah? So the distance I've shown here, and of course I selected this event so it's easy to see on the slide. Right? The distance here is about 30 centimeters. But the real problem is I can't tell you what the lifetimes are. So we have to be prepared for some different scenarios and think about how we would trigger in different contexts. Okay, the other common prediction of Hidden Valley scenarios is a big effect on supersymmetry, or on UED, or on little Higgs, or on any theory with a new global symmetry, R parity, KP parity, T parity, whatever parity you like, or some other Z3 symmetry, doesn't matter. The point is that in that case, there'll always be a particle like the LSP in our sector, and a particle like the LSP in their sector. And the question is just, who's heavier? If our LSP is heavier than their LSP, then ours is going to decay to theirs, eventually. And the lifetimes turn out, again, to be on LHC detector timescales. Very general. So we have a situation now where not only, so when this particle decays, it can produce scatter model particles, or B particles, or both. And both the LSP itself and the V particles may be long-lived, so there's a very wide variety of possible final states with displaced decays that we need to be prepared for. And this generalizes well-known work from the 1990s on things like gauge-mediated Suzy breaking, anomaly mediation, hidden sector. Some of the key participants are not in the room, and for the experimentalists who may not be familiar with all of this literature, I strongly encourage you to read these classic papers by people like Gunyan and Fang and Scott Thomas and Steve Martin. So, Steve Renner. Okay, here's two examples really quickly. Gluons collide to make squarks. The squarks decay to two jets and make two neutralinos. And the neutralinos, instead of going off as missing energy, they decay and they make a whole bunch of particles. So instead of a large missing energy signal, you have multiple soft jets and a low missing energy signal. Possibly, if you're lucky, multiple displaced vertices. And similarly, you can have this kind of physics with a stow, and now you get four taus on top of that, and possibly two charged tracks. So what can this look like? So here are three cases. Here's a case where both the neutralino and the V particles decay promptly. This is squarks go to one jet here and one jet there. Those are the hard jets. And instead of missing energy, here are the soft jets, which fill in the momentum. Here's a case where the neutralino is long-lived. You get these vertices here and here with lots of particles coming out. And here's another case where you have prompt neutralino decays. The neutralino is decaying here, but it spits off a bunch of V particles. And here's one decay here. Here's another one. Here's a third. And here's a fourth right at the edge of the calorimeter. Yeah.
Question. So these models, the V sector is sort of degrading but not completely eliminating the missing energy, or?
That's correct. And I have not done a proper study.
Will still be events with large missing energy in this scenario?
There will still be some. Now, of course, so the missing energy signal doesn't go away. But, of course, a degradation of missing energy signal on top of a standard model background, which is falling very steeply, could still be a serious matter. The studies haven't been done. I honestly do not know if this is a problem or not. Mainly because the Monte Carlo hasn't been written that can do this yet. It's on its way.
I mean, it does depend upon how prompt the decay is, right? If the decays are prompt, then you're down to sort of no missing energy, depending upon what the final state is.
Well, no, the point was, yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have emphasized that. There's the LSP, there's no R-parity violation in this context.
Oh,
so there's okay. It's just that you have an LSP here, and this part going off here is an LSP of the other sector. Thank you for the question. Okay. Indeed, I didn't clarify that. Okay. So those are some generic predictions. Here's an example of Stout decays. We have a nice charged track, which then decays to a big spray of particles. Again, these are not qualitatively entirely different from things that have been talked about before, but they just generalize the options. Okay, what I want to spend most of the rest of the time on is a much more energetic case where you produce a Z prime and the Z prime decays to the quarks. So what do I mean here? We imagine a hidden sector that is a gauge theory. It has quark-like objects that have their own forces, gluons, but I'm going to call them V-quarks and V-gluons to emphasize these are the quarks and gluons of the hidden sector. They don't carry any standard model quantum numbers. They're invisible to us. Nonetheless, just as a Q-bar pair can produce a Z-prime which decays to standard model particles, the Z-prime could also decay to quarks of this hidden sector. And those quarks have their own parton shower, a V-parton shower, which V-gluons are emitting. And then there's V-confinement and V-hadronization. And out come out two V-jets of V-hadrons. And some of those V-hadrons may be invisible and disappear from the detector, but others will decay in the detector with invisible particles, such as B2-bar pairs, lepton pairs, and so forth. And we can get a very busy event, like this. This is a not so busy, but there's something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 jets, or 8 partons produced in this case. These are probably 8 V-quarks in this particular example, which has a 3.2 TeV Z prime, and resonances, neutral resonances, which are decaying into V-bar pairs at 50 GeV. I call them V-pions, but the details don't matter. Here's a case where those resonances are long-lived, and now we get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 displaced vertices on this side, and one displaced vertex over here that you can see, and then there's this guy, which decayed in the calorimeter. Yes? The total visible mass. You're asking if I sum up the visible energy in the calorimeter and compute the invariant mass? That I don't know, but I can show you plots of the of what is known as HT, some scalar. And it's large. There's no serious problem here with triggering. If that's what's the nature of the question?
I'm just curious.
Yeah, I can show you plots. I haven't tried to compute the invariant mass. Of course, there's a long tail. In this particular model, about a third to two-thirds of the V particles produced are invisible. So in this particular model, you lose a lot of the invariant mass. But of course, your resolution would not be very good with this kind of event anyway.
When you show HT, can you specify whether or not you're including missing ET because you can define it in
your let me show you plots with some specific things. I mean, you obviously can plot many things. The point is that this signal is fairly dramatic, but I should emphasize the number of events you might have per year is 100 or 1,000. And so it's not going to stand out such a huge signal that you're going to easily collect it just using kinematic variables like that. You're going to have to do more.
Matt,
yes?
So if you were to apply an average jet algorithm to this, what are the ET spectra you would see with these jets?
So let me show this picture. This is the same case, 3.2 TeV, 50 GeV, the hadrons, and prompt decays. These three events are all in the same physical process. And so here you see the large fluctuations. So sometimes you might get two jets. Sometimes you may get 8. Sometimes you may get 4. And there's a wide distribution. And on top of that, there's this fact that some of these particles are produced with a large boost. And also there's so many of them that just you get accidental overlaps between the various particles that are produced. So the number of jets is typically far less than the number of standard model partons produced. The number of bottom quarks, for example, is typically 50% larger than the number of jets that you see, sometimes double the number of jets that you see. So the jet algorithms tend to take the partons and cluster them, and they're not telling you where the partons actually were. Well, they're not telling you where each individual parton is. They're telling you where clusters of partons are, to be precise. Yeah, I can show you more plots of that if you like.
But my ball is still the best jet clustering algorithm. If I just look at the tracks, it looks pretty clear.
So, very important point, indeed. Tracking has a lot of information for jet substructure, and we need to use it.
Well,
I was going to make a point about that. Yeah.
To do that, you have to know the momentum of the tracks. If that includes 1GB tracks, it's harder.
So, you're not... This is a very interesting thing for the discussion section. Let's come back to jet substructure as part of our discussion. So this is a great question, Ed, but it needs a long...
But a detailed question on what you're showing here is there a momentum effect for you?
The tracks...
Okay,
so thank you. Darker tracks are higher PT, the lighter tracks are lower PT, and I've put a cut... Obviously, I don't have magnetic field here, right? So, and that, of course, makes a big difference. So I've thrown away all tracks with 3 GeV or below to give you a little bit of a feel for what's there. I'm only showing the charge tracks, indeed. Go ahead.
Are those ones partons or jet aggregates?
These are tracks. This is a hadronization. This is what you'll see in the detector modulo the magnetic field. Yeah.
The relative widths to standard model fields and the particles
of the conical. So this is why it's so important there's that valley floor.
Right.
Once you get that, you asked about the Z prime? You asked about the Z prime. That's modeled. Right, that depends on the number of colors in the V-sector, it depends on how strong the interactions are in the V-sector. You know, you can make it anything you want, so I'm hesitant to say it's probably of order 1. In the simplest plots you can write down, it would be of order 1. But it could easily be a tenth or 1 or 10, and that's a big difference experimentally. So,
because, I mean, in order 1, you find it in the standard sector, and then you know the guy.
Good point. I'm not claiming here that this is a situation where you're necessarily going to have trouble finding the Z prime. You'll find the Z prime, and you may even see that it has an invisible width. But what if the case too? You won't know unless you find this. So, yeah, good question.
So just one more thing on the neutrals. The neutrals that are not shown here, they're still normal things like pi zeros and so forth.
Yes, they're
that
selected.
That would do something in the calorimeter of it, in the hadronic calorimeter.
Yeah, I mean, the calorimetry is shown out here.
Yes.
If that's what your question is.
Okay, so you have lots of stuff that's...
I have collected the neutrals.
Popping up in the okay.
Yeah. The neutrals are collected here.
Yeah.
And indeed, in the event I showed here, this is a case where we have a decay that's actually in the H-cal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no E-cal energy at all, or just from the underlying event. It's just a big 200 GeV blob of energy sitting in your H-cal. So that is kept track of. Okay, so you have these different events. They have to be collected together, and I've done a study, a preliminary study, which is, well, preliminary in the sense that it should have been done 6 months ago, but it's not done yet. So it's almost done, and I can certainly show you lots of plots. And let me just tell you some quick results. Triggering is not a problem here because the energies are high, but reconstruction analysis are going to be an issue because, for reasons I already mentioned, the number of hard jets is less, considerably less, than the number of hard partons are actually produced. The jets, therefore, don't necessarily tell you where the hard partons were, but it turns out they do tell you where the clusters of partons are. The clustering algorithm on the hadrons does, fortunately, at least if it's not too busy, tell you where the clusters of partons are. So there is some information. It's not all lost. On the other hand, that also means there are too few jets around to separate from backgrounds in a trivial way. For example, if these events have lots of bottom quarks, you might think, oh, gee, if you have 12 bottom quarks, no problem. No standard model backgrounds are that. Well, even if you, of course, there's tagging fractions, but even if you make the tagging probability pretty high, the problem is the number of jets around is small. So you're only going to get, if you only have 4 jets, the maximum number of B tagged jets you can get is 4. Clearly, that's not the right way to do the analysis. What you want is you don't want to treat the jets as objects. You want to really look at the correlation among where the jets are, where the vertices are, and where the displaced tracks are. And it's putting all that together that you can really deal with the complexity of this kind of event. Another thing, which is very important, I mentioned, is that moderate to high PT jets tend to be a single boosted V hadron. Let me show you a picture. Here's an event. These two clusters of tracks, which are giving you contributions in adjacent calorimeter cells cannot really be separated by the calorimeter. That's a single B hadron decaying to two quarks. Obviously, the tracker can give you a lot more information, and you should use it. Okay. So the calorimeter tells you about the energy. The tracker tells you about the angles. They have different resolutions for different things. You can put them together in some optimal way, which is detector-dependent, but should certainly be worked out. Okay, and finally, the overall event shape is unusual. You may need novel shape variables. I'm working on this a little bit with Steve Ellis and some students, and Catherine will also talk about that a little bit, I think, in the discussion session. She's been working on it, too. Okay, I want to emphasize something. You need multi-particle production for this to work. I want to make sure it's clear. The multi-particle production starts here, at the parton shower. This is not a hadronization effect. It's an all-scales effect. It's the effect of the parton shower, which is the quasi-conformal dynamics of an interacting gauge theory. It's an all-scales effect. This is why the Z boson decays to many QCD hadrons. It's because of this is why multiplicities go up. Right? It's really because of the parton shower, as much as hadronization. And it's important to keep in mind that QCD is a nearly conformal field theory. There's a lot of powerful techniques you can use, and I'll mention one at the end. Here are some references if you're interested, especially the uses of conformal symmetry in QCD. Papers by our friend Brodsky and some others as far back as 79, even earlier, and a couple of nice papers recently in the unparticle literature. And I'll return to that later. Okay, a couple of quick things just to sort of whet your appetite for what we might discuss. In QCD, we already know that we can have flavor-changing decay. If we have one quark decays to another quark, decays to another quark, each time producing more pions. What if that's in the hidden set? Well, the problem is that we know what happens in QCD because we measure it. If you change the mass ratios of the various quarks, you change the mass ratios of the hadrons, you change the decay process, you really don't know what you're going to see. So the best you could do is guess right now. You could try to do better in some cases. One thing you can certainly get is there's some particle you produce here, and on its way out of the detector, it decays down and down and down, just the way the bottom neutrons do, in a chain. And then you may even have a sequence of displaced decays, or maybe not all of them are displaced, coming out of the detector more or less in the same direction. That's also a very interesting, challenging signal for pattern recognition software, and it's something to think about. Here's something for the theorists, as well as the experimenters. Supposing the B sector is just a pure Young-Mills theory. This is a very important case because it's often the situation that you might have a more complicated B sector, but the very low energy dynamics is just glue. What happens in this case? Supposing, for example, we have a heavy scalar that couples to the standard model in some way, and it couples to a hidden sector via a trace F mu squared operator, to a big gluon operator. Then you might have a process where glue, and the standard model produces the scalar, and then it decays the gluons in the hidden sector, which then undergo a parton shower, hadronization, out come a bunch of V glue balls, which then decay back to the standard model. How does this happen? Well, we can't calculate this on a piece of paper. What we know is from the lattice. And what we know from the lattice is that there are 6 or 7 V glue balls that cannot decay to other glue balls. Their masses are in a range of about a factor of 2, and they're simply kinematically unable to decay. They have different CP final numbers and different spins. Their masses are different. They, therefore, when they decay to the standard model, they have to decay by a different modes because there are different selection rules. So they're going to come out with different final states and different lifetimes, vastly different lifetimes. No one's calculated this. But the point is, because you have several resonances with widely different lifetimes, the probability that one of them is in the magic range, that you will see it in your detector, is much larger than you would typically think in many other scenarios where displacements arise. Okay, so the probability of finding this is higher than people think. Now, if you want to ask what specifically would you see in this theory and what exactly the cosmological constraints in this scenario and so forth, we could calculate this, but it hasn't really been done properly at this point.
Now, let me just show my ignorance. The statement in the lattice tells you there's 6 or 7 stable V glue balls. Sort of blows my mind. What? Can you say a little more? What goes into that? How do you know?
So what you do is you calculate. You take various gauge invariant operators in the gauge theory, and you compute their two-point functions, which tells you what is propagating from one point to another. And what propagates from one point to another is all of the hadrons of the theory, whatever they might be. So that's technically how it's done. So you take different operators. You take operators of spin 1 and CP quantum numbers plus. You take 0 plus minus gauge invariant operators. And you compute these two-point functions. And you look, as you move the operators apart, what is propagating from here to here.
And you discover... And why is it true in QCD?
Because everything decays to pions and nucleons. because the pions are so light.
This is a theory without quarks, and so without quarks, they can actually do accurate lattice calculations.
I got it.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's part of the
problem.
Okay, yeah, so, right.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, so this, right, so there's two issues. First of all, the lattice, right, the lattice can really compute this.
Yeah.
The lattice can really compute this. And of course, in QCD, in real QCD, where you have light pions, you don't have so many stable states. But in a generic theory, you do. Okay, another very important piece of, yeah. Well, so they can decay precisely back through this same mechanism. This same operator, which couples our sector to their sector, will also couple the blue balls, which are, after all, things like they're created by these same operators, trace F squared, trace F blue, and so forth. They'll allow those same decays. But some of them will decay directly, and some of them have to decay through a loop, and some of them have to decay two bodies, three bodies. It's complicated. There was another question over here? All right, another thing we take for granted that we shouldn't take for granted. Hartong-Hadron duality. We're used to the idea that if you create a hard quark, or you create a hard gluon, out the other end comes a jet. Not so. This is what we're used to. Now, really, I should draw the parton shower here and then show this string that forms as confinement sits in. I'm going to not draw the parton shower, just for simplicity. You should remember the parton shower starts this whole process. But at some point, as confinement sets in, if you produce a V-quark anti-V-quark pair, a V-string will form between them. And if there are light V-quarks, then this string will begin to snap very rapidly. If the number, in particular, like in QCD, if the number of light quarks, little n, and the number of colors in this V-sector, capital N, are of the same order, then the probability for this snapping to occur is order 1. So you'll end up with this, all this energy which is stored here gets spread out into a bunch of little pieces of string which we call hadrons. And you end up with one jet going this way and another jet going that way. And a few particles in the middle. This is what we're used to. But if there are no light V-quarks, and there's just a couple of heavy V-quarks that you produce here, then the string will not break. It has an exponentially small probability of breaking. So what happens? You produce these V-quarks, they move apart, they're bound by a flux tube, they slow down, they turn around, they come back. Okay, this thing starts swinging back and forth on microscopic timescales, and every time it comes past itself, remember this is not a classical thing, this is a quantum mechanical thing, there's a certain probability that it will develop a ripple, and it will twist back on itself, and a piece will pop off. The piece that pops off is called a blue ball. That's what blue balls are from this point of view. So what will happen is gradually this thing will decay down by spitting off blue balls. And eventually this little pair here, which is a heavy V quark and an anti-V quark, will find each other and they will annihilate. And when they annihilate, they will annihilate to a bunch more blue balls. So what do you get? I don't know, but it's going to look pretty spherical probably. There might be some remnants of the original direction, but it's probably very spherical. How many blue balls are produced? What their peaky spectrum is? What their angular distribution is? How long this takes? And what the LHC would actually observe, I haven't a clue. But this could easily be there. Yeah. Good. Yeah, this is something we discussed a little bit in our original paper, but it hasn't been explored further by us.
Is and this a subcase or a supercase of the quark business?
Of the quark business.
Yeah.
So the quarks, I think, specifically, it's very close to what let me say something about that in just a second. Because a lot of the dynamics is the same, but there's some specific issues which are different. In particular, what I'm referring to right now is just V-quarks which don't carry any standard model quantum numbers. But if they do, then it becomes quarks. And because then you start to get standard model. This is part of where the concepts overlap, which
okay.
is great for us. Another possibility is you're in between, and the string snaps a couple of times. And if you're in between, what happens is you end up with two or three fairly heavy hadrons, which are themselves strings flipping back and forth, each one of which will decay spherically in the rest frame, but they're moving back and forth. So here you can get one jet which is fairly narrow from a fairly heavy object, and here you get a jet which is very fat on the other side, in fact, even throws particles backwards. So you get a very wide variety, event to event, you get very different pictures depending exactly where the string snaps and how often.
Where
is
little n
capital n? So, I'm sorry. Little n is the number of light quarks, and capital N is the number of colors. So if you have one light V-quark and 60 colors, you might start to run into this, which we don't see in QCD, where we have 3 and 3. Okay, so it precisely addresses the question, what if the ends of the string have color and electric charge? Well, then these are these quirks. And we'll talk, we're going to hear a whole review article on it. I just want to make a couple of comments. Here we're talking about a very high confinement scale, about 100 GeV, as opposed to what Kang Li was talking about, which is very, very interesting and very different original type of thing. Here, the decays for these things are microscopic. You don't actually see anything in the detector moving through the detector. That's something else. But in this case, there are very interesting questions, how these strings decay down, and what sort of electromagnetic and color interactions are observable. I guess we're going to hear about some of that today. I didn't really understand how to do that right, but I guess people have figured it out, which would be great. Another interesting question is, when you produce these things, what other B particles do you produce along with them, which you might observe, as a clue to what physics you're actually observing? Finally, if there are light B quarks and you produce things that carry electric charge, then you can produce new bound states where you have, let's say, a composite where the total composite carries electric charge. This will look like a heavy lepton or a heavy hadron. And again, you can ask the question, what happens if you produce this? Well, if you produce something that looks like a heavy lepton, it just looks like, we know heavy leptons are. They just look like back-to-back tracks going through the detector into the muon system. But if they're composites, then sometimes something else will be emitted along with them, which might be invisible and provide a source of missing energy, or might decay halfway through the detector, or even the thing you produce might decay halfway through, because so there's a lot of interesting possibilities to explore, something for our discussion. Okay, I want to come back to multi-particle production in QCD with the remaining time. So let me come to my favorite B sectors. These are strongly coupled field theories which you might put in the hidden sector with large anomalous dimensions and a mass gap in the B sector. There's a lot of examples going back a long time. Walking technicolor, if you like, is a nice example of this. Many people worked on this, including John and other people in the room. Supersymmetric gauge theories in the 1990s, lots of people worked on this as well. Supersymmetry breaking models are of this type in many cases. Flavor physics driven by anomalous dimensions. There's some nice, very nice work on this. I see I left off Sigmund's name here. and I've left off names here partly because I didn't have access to that because my flight was so late last night. I couldn't even get access to the internet. So I apologize if I left your name off. There are definitely people in here I think I did not. Who should be on this list. And then, more recently, gauge theories and string theory dual descriptions are often of this type. So, work by John and friends, by Randall and Sundrum, and some work I've done with Polchinski and Klovanov are of this class as well. Now, this is a delicate point. If you take a hidden valley that has a conformal field theory with a mass gap of hidden sector, this is a subclass of hidden valley models. It's also a subclass of uncoupled. And there's a big overlap region here. And I'd just like to make a couple of comments about it. First of all, I think it would be I'd like to make a suggestion and a personal request. The suggestion is that in this overlap region, where we have both hidden valley-like physics and unparticle physics happening simultaneously, that we just call these hidden valley/unparticle models.
Not unparticle
hidden valley. That I don't care. But the important thing is, I think it's fair.
Okay.
It gives credit to everybody rather than to only some people. And the other thing is, I think it's important. It's important conceptually, but especially for experimenters. We are not talking about different theories. We're talking about two different viewpoints of the same theory. You don't want to be having an experimental hidden valley group and an experimental unparticle group doing simultaneous searches. They should be coordinated. Right? So we've got one theory here looked at from two different points of view. Now, when George's original paper, I should note, is not a hidden valley model. He doesn't have a mass gap. But once people started putting mass gaps in, this now comes into this overlap region. And for various historical reasons, this is often not noticed by the workers in that field. And for that reason, I would like to make a personal request if you are one of those people. What I'd like to request is that you take a look at the Hidden Valley papers carefully and read them through. And I would be very happy to answer any questions that you might have. And if it seems appropriate to you, having looked at the physics in detail, would really appreciate it if you would add a citation to our work, to your talks and your papers. At this point, George I has about 80 citations, and since May, we have 3. And, you know, I have plenty of citations, and of course, George I does too, but Catherine does too. It's really not fair. So please, take out the papers, decide for yourselves, and you don't have to do this, but please, we'd really appreciate it if you take a look at them, and if appropriate, add a citation, and encourage others to do so as well. And for if you would honor that request, we would be profoundly grateful. Yeah. Yeah.
Could I just
But the picture shows the opening, right? If you put that's the point. This is all you need. What my point was that all it takes for Hidden Valley modeling, all of the predictions that we made, all it takes is a barrier, multi-particle, some sort of coupling, multi-particle production in here, and a mass gap. And there's no requirement that the multi-particle production in here be a weakly coupled theory that has small anomalous dimensions and isn't a conformal field theory. That's not a requirement. Any of the field theories that we know of, large or small anomalous dimensions, large or small couplings, beta function or not, they all do this. It's all within the same scenario, and it all comes with the same predictions. The detail they vary, but not the generic predictions that I laid out.
I'm
going to explain this more in a minute. Yeah.
Normally, when I think of the unparticle model, I think of the unparticles as being invisible and having very weak, such long lifetimes.
Hear me out, okay? I'm going to explain all this. Okay, and I am going to take a few extra minutes because of the questions. Is that okay?
I just want to say we have 30 minutes of questions, so you guys better come up with some more questions.
I will do what I've been doing, which is answer questions in detail.
I think this is exactly
this is what we want.
So this is certainly a place where we can have some additional discussions. I have some additional backup slides if we get into more detail, and so forth. So as I said, I'd like to suggest that we call these Hidden Valley slash unparticle models, and I really want to emphasize, I think having both designations is valuable because people have been studying similar questions from different points of view and actually looking at different phenomena that are both there. Now, in conformal field theories, there are certain challenges for computation, but as I've said, the dominant signals often resemble what I've already shown. Now, here's a technical point that's very important for the people who are working in this field. Many of you know this, but I just want to make sure it's said. First of all known conformal field theories in four dimensions are gauge theories. There are various reasons having to do with unitarity why this is believed to be the case. And you've got to be very careful because the typical technique in the unparticle literature is to use local gauge invariant operators. And you can't write down all the dynamics of a gauge theory using local gauge invariant operators. For example, how do you see a parton shower in QCD using local gauge invariant operators? Okay, you're going to really get yourself into some challenges. Now you can do it. Yes? Are you going to say something? Yes, you can do it using SCAP. Those are local operators. They're Wilson lines, right? I mean, the point is you can't do it using local operators. You have to remember that QCD has a light cone, and a lot of the physics is associated with physics near the light cone, and those are not local operators. And so you have to be very careful interpreting your results when you work with gauge invariant local operators. The alternative is to work with Fox and Gluon, which is essentially what Catherine and I did, and then you get confused about other things, but you don't get confused about that.
So just a technical thing here. For the microphone, it's really helpful since discussion is going to be such an important part of this meeting. We hope that you speak up as loudly and project as much as you possibly can. And if Matt repeats the questions
a
little bit and so forth, then we'll have a full record. Okay.
Thank you. I'll try very hard. Is there any question about this point? Let me make a suggestion. If it's not entirely obvious to you. Try writing down just a free gauge theory. Take a gauge theory with an arbitrarily small coupling and try to write down its physics in terms of gauge invariant operators. You'll notice some funny things. For example, if you compute the unparticle propagators, they're quite interesting. They're just composite operators, of course. F mu squared is the propagator of F mu squared. It's an interesting propagator. It even has 3 and 4 point functions. It looks like an interacting theory. It's just a free theory. You're just calculating loops in background fields in a free theory. But these functions don't vanish. You have to be very careful about the interpretation. And then once you have done that with the free theory, then take a look at something like the Banks-Zaks fixed point, which is more or less computable, and see if you can find the parton shower in there. Okay, so now let me take a few moments to talk about these conformal field theories. So there are three quantities you have to keep track of. One is alpha, the coupling constant. The second is beta, the running of the coupling constant. How fast is it changing with scale? And the third is gamma, anomalous dimensions of operators. How far do operators in the gauge theory differ from their naive values? and they can differ by quite a lot. So, in general, if you take alpha and you multiply by the number of colors, there's three different regions, more or less. I mean, this is a cheat, but it's more or less, right? You can have small coupling, you can have large coupling, you can have extremely large coupling, and the anomalous dimensions go along for the ride. Not all of them, but some operators, all operators will have small anomalous dimensions here, some operators will have large anomalous dimensions here, and some operators will have extremely large anomalous dimensions here, where an operator that naively is an operator dimension 2 might be an operator dimension 20, for example. Independent of that, you can have zero beta function, a small beta function, or a large beta function. Well, if you have a large beta function, you can't stay here for very long. But all of the other possibilities are there. So here are some conformal field theories. And here are some theories of the small beta function. If you don't know exactly what these are, that's okay. The point is that there are lots known. And I think you would probably say that these theories in here are strictly unparticle models. And these ones here are pretty close to unparticle models. And all the models in green have mass gaps, and those would be invalid centers. Those would be good invalid centers. So there's quite a bit of overlap in these specific, in some of these specific cases. Okay. Now, what kinds of effects does having large anomalous dimensions do? Well, here is the case that I talked about before. You make a Z prime, the Z prime makes a pair of jets through the parton shower. The parton shower is controlled by a splitting function. The splitting function, I can explain this in detail later if you want. It's controlled by a splitting function whose moments are related to operator anomalous dimensions. If you crank up the anomalous dimensions, you're cranking up the rate of splitting. You're cranking up how quickly the collinear physics here goes away. And so if you go to very strong coupling, you're going to lose the collinear physics and end up with soft physics. The only thing I don't know is if it's spherical or not. This is the kind of event you might end up with. So whereas here, this is one of those Z prime models I described before, you get sort of a quasi-jet here and a very fat jet here of V hadrons, which are each decaying to bottom quark pairs. There's something like 10 V hadrons here, 20 bottom quarks total.
Sorry,
yeah.
You're going a little too fast for me. What is this model? What's in the V sector here?
Okay, but to be precise, if you want to know, this is sort of, again, to be predictive and we know what we're doing. This particular simulation is with a sector that has something very close to QCD itself. So it has two light quarks and gluons. And that's nice because I can use Pythia and it's tuned to data and I know what I'm doing.
And
so I know we could see this.
So then another question, why aren't there two jets? Why is it so spherical?
Ah, because these, so we have 3.2, great question, 3.2 TeV. We distribute it in much the same way we distribute Z goes to pions. Some of the pions are very hard. Some of them are rather soft. And they all have mass of about 50 GeV. The soft ones, they're 50 GeV and they're not moving very fast. When they decay, they create a pair of 25 GeV jets, which go off at random angles. The hard ones, of course, create a pair of high PT jets next to each other. So most of the energy is here. These are hard jets from V hadrons that are moving fast. Here, just by chance, the V hadrons were not moving as fast, but there weren't as many moving as fast. So the slower ones tend to give us things like this, or maybe things like that, and the very slow ones can give us just stuff going off to the side.
But is this then really different? If it was QCD, wouldn't we have the same thing? Wouldn't we have the same, roughly the same kinds of distributions with roughly the same probability?
So let's take the following exercise. Supposing you took a Z boson decay. Okay, imagine you get a Z boson decay to pions, and now imagine that you can't see the pions. All you can see are the photons, the muons, the electrons, and the neutrinos. And ask, where do they all go?
So you're assuming that there's some energy in the V sector that we don't pick up here? So
no, go. Okay. There's two layers of physics here. That's part of what, that's right. There's the Z prime itself. That's a 3.2 TeV scale. Then that showers and creates hadrons in the V sector, which has 50 GeV. And then those 50 GeV particles in turn decay to 5 or 1 GeV particles. And the fact that you have two stages in the kinematics produces events that look like this. You could get the same qualitative kinematics in the real world if you scale the question down. Ask, what I'm saying is there's an analogous question. If you ask where in Z decay...
The showers, the strong interaction scale is assumed to be much higher in the V sector than the QCD.
Yes,
so
it's 50 GeV.
The effects are much bigger. That's sort of like QCD with a larger hadronization.
The QCD
scale.
larger pion
larger
mass scale.
Larger hadron scale.
So there's V hadronization at a scale of 100 GeV.
Yeah,
and then there's QCD hadronization scale of 100 MeV.
I understand.
They each provide some activity.
Even though there's an underlying collinear singularity, just as in QCD, is never realized because the pions are sort of made before, these very massive pions are sort of made before.
No, I mean, there's a collinear singularity in here.
The pion, usually you cut off in QCD simulations, you cut off that collinear singularity using the pion mass scale, and that's where you stop your radiation
process. So let's follow the stages, there's more stages here than I've drawn, and I understand that I've gone through this too fast, so let me try one last time. So we start with a Z prime and we make quarks in a new sector. These have collinear singularities and have a quarton shower in their own sector, which gets cut off by the hadronization scale in that sector, which is 100 GeV.
Yeah.
Then we have those particles. They live for a while. They hang out for, you know, a femtosecond or something, maybe even a picosecond. Then they decay. But when they decay, now they've suddenly produced a pair of bottom quarks, which then undergo QCD hadronization down to the 100 MeV scale. And those produce all these hadrons. But the hadrons themselves are coming from bottom quarks, which themselves were emitted from V hadrons, which were created in V hadronization, which was generated by V showering from the Z prime decay. It's the fact that you have the complicated physics in the V sector followed by the decay of the standard model and the complicated standard model physics together. Yeah?
So, if I understand correctly, this is like
a plus and minus
of 30 GeV.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. But
it is, but again, that's why I'm emphasizing. Yeah. But see, it is jetty. And this is jetty. It's just that in when you do measurements of E plus E minus goes to hadrons, the way you look at it is you watch the tracks of the charged pions, which live a long time. And you see that the charged pions form a jet. But when the pions decay, the muons that they decay to, where do they go? The high PT pions, the muons go forward. The low PT pions, the muons go sideways. If you collected all the muons from pion decay, they would be all over the place. The hard ones would be in a jet, but then there'd be soft ones all over the place. That's what we're doing here. Yeah. Well, you can see it. Here's a jet. This event is maybe not as jetty as some, but of course there are fluctuations. But compare that with the strong coupling situation. Okay, that's not jetty. This is spherical. Lots more soft pions. Imagine a Z prime, imagine a Z boson, which instead of decaying to two jets, it just decays to lots of soft pions that all go in all directions. Or maybe not in all directions, but try to calculate where they go. Not so easy.
Mike, speak up.
This
is a Z prime at 3 TeV. So in this particular case, the theory is just, again, to make it simulable without any worries.
Right.
Not this case, because but this case where I can really simulate without any worries, it's just scaled up QCD. So the V pion mass is 50 GeV, so that's about a factor of 30.
Okay.
So the hadronization scale is, you know, 200, 300 GeV in the V sector. How do you do this calculation? You can't really do it reliably. The best you can do. So what I did was I took the Monte Carlo that I wrote for the previous event. I fixed the coupling constant. I fixed it at a large value. And I just let Pythia do its naive Quarton shower with a large coupling. And that's surely wrong. But the problem is I can't do any better.
This is like E plus E minus a couple of GeV instead of the case.
No, this is still at 30 GeV, but with strong coupling in the QCD sector. That's what this is. Imagine the QCD, instead of being a weakly coupled theory of high energy, had a fixed point at alpha of order 1. Okay, then you would have much more rapid quarton showering, and things would go all over the place. I don't know whether it has to be 1 or it has to be 10. I mean, the things we don't know. But you can at least calculate some. You can calculate the approach to this using reliable methods.
Is there a non-perturbative hadronization scale in this
There has to be. In this case, about 200 GeV, I think. 150 GeV. The important point is the Parton shower is very efficient if the coupling constant is very large. The hybridization is not really different, at least as far as we know. It's the conformal physics above the hybridization scale, which are the quasi-conformal physics, which is so different. As large as you want. Although don't forget, in the duality cascade, you can even have a non-zero beta function still have the coupling constant very large.
What role do other objects like the analogy this thing to the row play?
So when you make a row, of course, in QCD, it immediately decays to pions. And similarly here, the V row decays immediately to V pions. So if you were really clever, you might even be able to find that resonance here. But it turns out to be really hard in almost any model that I've looked at so far. It's a good question, though, because that also could produce some additional substructure. I just haven't been able to pull it out, even when I knew it was there.
And it's hard because the pions aren't jetty. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, you have to collect... You know, if you had a row meson which decayed to things which always went to leptons, you know, then you could reconstruct the resonance. But we're talking here about things going to bottom quarks, right? Or you know, jets in general most of the time. So trying to, it's just hard to reconstruct the resonance for jets. My God, you know that as much as anyone. So Catherine is making the point that if you do have some branching fraction to leptons, obviously that the signal is so clean that you could potentially pull it up. But the number of events here is so small, and the branching fraction to leptons tends not to be so big, that you'd be lucky to get four. So it's definitely not impossible, but it's unlikely that it's first order. It's unlikely that that's the way you discover it. On the other hand, I think Catherine's point is that if you have a decay of leptons, then discovering not the row, but the pi, or whatever the analogy is, the pi will go to leptons. But other things will go to leptons with a reasonable rate. Discovering that, of course, is much higher probability. And Catherine, I guess, will say something about some work that she's been up to later.
For the randomization to leptons, you say it's not very large. Can you give a ballpark number? What are we talking about?
It's not going to be that different from what you would guess, just saying, look, there are a certain number of quarks in the standard model times three colors, and there are a certain number of leptons in the standard model. And so unless I force this particle to only couple to leptons, typically it's going to go to quarks more often just because there are more quarks. Now, and of course, tau's don't really count. So you're really asking, what's the fraction to mu's and e's? And that could be 10%, it could be 20%, it could be 5%. It's typically of that order. Yeah.
Why do you have the pions decaying to these? I mean, if
if you have a 50 GeV particle that's a pseudoscalar and it's decaying through a Z prime or even through a Higgs, it's always going to end up coupling to heavy flavor more strongly. So you get bottom quarks most of the time, charm and tau sometimes, mu's are very rare. It would have to be some other particle in the theory. But in a QCD-like theory that has light pions, you're going to get most of these. But in some other theories where you have a bunch of resonances, some of them may decay to leptons with a reasonable rate. If you have some stable vector meson, and there are lots of theories with stable spin one particles, those can easily go to leptons. Okay, so again, one has to think outside the QCD box. There are many other scenarios, and leptons. So lepton pairs, again, Catherine will say more about that, are a very important signal to look for. In rare weird events. Okay, I haven't really violated the rule yet. I have three more slides. So are there any more questions about this? I mean, I obviously have gone too fast for some purposes, so if there are any other general questions you want me to go back at this point, I could do it. Okay, so let me say a couple of more words about the Hidden Valley unparticle models and what it is physically that's going on here. This is for experimentalists, but also for some theorists, probably. Let's take the Z-prime model that I've been talking about just as an example. We could also take the model of that scalar between the two sectors as an example. Lots of different examples we could take. So, for example, we have, as a result of the Z-prime, a coupling between, let's say, the axial current in the standard model and the axial current in the V-sector, with some coupling constant I'll just call F. Its details don't matter. But the point is there's some coupling of some type between the two. and let's work so that we don't have to worry about the resonance. Let's work a little bit below the resonance. So we can really say this is like a local product of two operators. Okay. So this is some four fermion interaction, two fermions in the standard model, two fermions in the B sector, basically. Now, if the V sector is a conformal field theory in the ultraviolet, and again, I'm assuming there's an aspect, so it's not a conformal field theory all the way down to the infrared, but if it's a conformal field theory, even approximately a conformal field theory in the ultraviolet, then the operator O2 will have a fixed dimension D. What do I mean by that? I mean that if I compute the two-point function of two of these operators at points X and Y, you can draw this funny diagram, but look, it's just a two-point function, it's the Fourier transform of 1 over X minus Y to the 2D. Okay, that's not quite right because these are operators of spin 1, but it's basic. Okay, up to some numerator factors, it's basically what it is. It's the Fourier transform of a power law. Now, what's going on physically is that if you put O2 here, it travels through the waves, and then it knows that it's a bilinear in the V quarks, so it produces V quarks and all the interacting gluons that are in there, and then it comes back to itself. And then it does it again, and it does it again. You sum up all these bubble diagrams, more or less, and you get this pattern, more or less. Now, there's a couple of things to notice. First of all, this operator in general will have dimension much larger, well, larger than 1. Why? Well, it's a composite operator. Composite operators have dimension larger than 1. Or in general, in a conformal field, it just means that this is some operator which mixes with a composite operator. And as a result of mixing, that operator dimension might be 1.32. It's a mixing operator. Interactions mix operators of the free theory together and give you various dimensions. Now, why this is an important part, which is, I think, important to keep in mind physically. There's a unitarity constraint, which will require scalar operators have dimension larger than 1. What does that mean? If you have a composite operator, it has to spread out. What it creates has to spread out faster than a free particle. So, for example, if I take a free particle and I produce it at point x, and I ask what's the probability that I will find, probably amplitude that I will find at point y, it's 1 over x minus y squared. If I take a composite thing, some interacting stuff, and I produce it, there's a certain probability I can produce it here, and it will all go out and come back to the point y. That, of course, is a lower probability than for a free particle, because there's also a probability that the stuff I produce will just kind of spread out and go on forever and never come back. So that's why there's a power law which always has to be a stronger power than for a free particle. It's a good way to think about it. Okay, so if we look at LHC signals below the Z-prime resonance, this would be a kind of calculation that one would do in an unparticle model. You take standard model particles from that are in the operator O1, they produce the hidden sector operator O2, which propagates along, and then comes back to O1. This is standard model particles, goes to something complicated, comes back to standard model particles. This is an effect which is in order F squared, where F is the coupling. Now, what is this? Well, in the Z prime model, this is a contribution to the low energy tail of the line shape. It's a change in the Breit-Wigner. It's telling you that the Breit-Wigner is wider and maybe weirdly shaped as a result of the fact that the Z prime can interact with all this stuff. But this is telling you there's a large imaginary part here. And of course, if you can do this, this is telling you the Z prime can decay. It's telling you that this is happening. And if this is visible, this is what, of course, you would want to look for. If it's not visible, or very hard to see, then you may need to find out about it indirectly, but this is an order F squared effect on the tail. This is the effect which, if it's visible, will dominate. And this is why Catherine and I focused on it. But I think it's also very important to keep in mind that when you calculate this, you're calculating something which is complementary to this, and they need to be cross-checked against each other. They're different information about the same model. So this is why I really think we need to combine these subjects together. And this generalizes to many other calculations that one can do. Any questions about that? Okay, so I'm done. The summary is, the hidden valley scenario is a hidden sector, which is coupled to the standard model of T via accessible energies. It has multi-particle production mechanism in the hidden sector. It doesn't matter too much what it is. And it has a mass gap or a ledge of some type which allows some of the particles in there to decay back to the standard model. With those ingredients, you get some generic predictions, multi-particle final states with new resonances in them, several possible sources for new long-lived particles among those resonances, new decay channels for the Higgs, new decay channels for the LSP, LKP, LTP, whatever you want. There are also rare decays for the Z, maybe even the W, right-hand neutrinos, and so forth. And the key thing is that there are many new and unusual states of the LHC to think about and to make sure that we can find. And the importance of all this is that there are real challenges here that have to be dealt with. There are challenges in some cases for the triggering system. Those, of course, are extremely urgent, and we can talk about those. There's some work already being done. But there are also challenges for reconstruction and analysis, because if you store these events, if you, in the process of reconstructing them, you misreconstruct them, or you reconstruct them in a way that doesn't really characterize what's special about them, then when you go to do analysis, it's very hard to find them. On the other hand, if you don't understand how to do analysis before we get to the LHC, you don't know what the reconstruction challenges, how the reconstruction challenges should be solved. So these two problems of reconstruction analysis are coupled together. One should really try to do a little better on this so that the software at CMS and Atlas in particular are better able to handle this. We certainly have some problems doing CDF and D0 searches because of the reconstruction software, which means if you want to do any searches, you have to rerun all sorts of data from scratch. And then, as I mentioned, there are lots of theoretical challenges because there are lots of these models that we can't calculate, so we can't even tell the experimentalists what to look for, and we could certainly use some additional work on that subject by, I think, a wide variety of people with different skill sets. So, and I finally, as I mentioned, I think it's important to realize that Hidden Valley and unparticle models have a big overlap region. In that overlap region, we need to make sure that we have a good theoretical synthesis so that we provide the experimentalists with the best information that they can get. Thank you. Yeah. Speak up.
There's a lot of space structures in many of these models. So how far out can we actually see the space structures? I mean, if the case after you get the factor, obviously, you won't be able to see that.
It really depends on the detector and what you're using to vertex.
Speak up.
It really depends on the detector and what you're using to vertex, right? In detectors like D0 and Atlas, you can actually reconstruct the direction of the shallow.
That's three orders, but this is part of my. And also, there's some chance of going out to. Go ahead. But let's assume, for example, in the Z prime case, you may just trigger on jets plus fizzing energy. Now you have something which travels out and decays to BB bar pairs. There's some fraction of time you get two muons in there. So you might see a dump of energy in the H cal with no E cal energy, and then two muons coming out that you can vertex. So I think if you think imaginatively, you could actually go out to the full 10 meters and get the full 4 orders of magnitude that are potentially available. But it's not easy. None of it's easy. Well, Dan Ventura is the expert on this, and he can talk about that.
What future requires magic and
aircraft?
Yeah, well, you end up with a lot of backgrounds.
So just to repeat, because I think probably the microphone's not picking it up. The statement is that in Atlas, and I believe this is similar in CMS. There's an issue that one of the first things you do after you get out of level one is you check to see whether a muon is matched to a track that goes back to the origin. Otherwise, you get a lot of backgrounds from various detectors and
even level one, right? You're not really looking at mean patterns, but
even level one, you pay your price.
Lookup table that assumes that
that's right.
Muons originate.
But even if they get to level one, in many cases they get thrown away at level two. However, there are some techniques to deal with that in some cases. But that's the technical point. Taken longer. Yeah, I mean, for particles that are produced near threshold, I mean, a lot of the things I was talking about, you're producing these particles in a decay, so they're often quite boosted. But for those that are quite commonly produced with relatively low boost, then indeed you start getting into timing issues, which again are very detector dependent. I don't really understand either the issues in either the type of
instance.
Otherwise,
our cleanup cuts will clean them right up.
Right. The quality control is always a risk with certain types of quality control. We throw away these signals.
It would be useful to make a table of all the things you'd like people to look for, and then take Atlas and CMS and see which ones will not survive the trigger.
Well, that's, I guess, something that we can draw a table as a result of the discussion.
So what I have done in talks that I've given, especially at CMS, I guess, I may not have given this talk to a wide group at Atlas, is I've laid out the following suggestion. The worst, in some sense, one of the worst and most serious triggering problems that you could run into, where your trigger rates are very low, is where the Higgs decays to two particles and then those two particles decay, because the energies are low. And we have no idea what the lifetimes are. We don't even know what those particles are going to decay to, whether they decay to gluons, or electrons, or muons, or B quarks, and so forth. And you can imagine doing a systematic study, which Dan is a part of on the Atlas side, of going through Higgs decays to various final states with various lifetimes, and just trying to understand what are the most efficient trigger techniques that you can use, which cover the most things at once. You don't want to introduce 50 different triggers for things you don't know what you're looking for. You'd like to find three or four different techniques that are very powerful and cover a lot of range very quickly. And that study's
on the way. You could
do that, certainly, but with Higgs, you're already paying a price at level one, so you'd really like to be very, in some sense, you're pushing the limits on efficiency. You'd like to be as efficient as possible. So. But look, I mean, that's for you to decide. This is a suggestion. My question. So the question was, how much can you learn about the V sector from the jetty structure of these Z prime decays? How much are you losing from the fact that some fraction, an unknown fraction of the V particles, are invisible because they don't decay at all, or they decay outside the detector? And you know, this is unfortunately a very model-dependent question, but a very interesting one. I'm not sure we'll get enough events at the LHC, at least in the first few years, to really address that. So I would view that as a second-order question. I think there's still a first-order question as to how we can discover these things. And until I'm sure that that's settled, I haven't been thinking about some of those second-order things. But I agree, that's a very interesting question. Because, of course, you would learn something about the coupling constant and about whether it is a sort of perturbative QCD-like theory by looking at that. And of course, if it's one of these theories where parton hadron duality is breaking down, goodness knows what you'll find, right? Shape analysis will give you some real surprises.
So the claim is that there was some way to separate out the planets and the planets. But they eventually
were
able to
dwell on
the
So if you were very lucky, but you'd have to be very lucky, you could have a situation where the separation in scales between the Z prime mass and the hadrons that you're producing, or the confinement scale, really, is large enough that you're really getting jetty structure, because that sounds so broad that you don't get and see anything. And you have long-lived particles. Typically, those go against each other because you have to. Well, sorry, they don't. I said it wrong. They don't go against each other. Well, and the third thing you need, they go together. Actually. And the third thing you need is a large rate. That's what goes against it. Okay? Because left constraints will tell you that if you have lots of light particles with lifetimes that could have coupled to the Z with any reasonable rate, you probably would know them. So, what is more likely if you have particles with long lifetimes is that the rates are probably going to be more on the 100 event per year or less. And then you're going to have an efficiency question where you only pick up half of them. Okay, so 30 events a year, it's going to be tough. It's not that it's impossible in principle, it's just that I think that what you'd actually know at that point would be limited. But look, we wouldn't care, right? We'd have thousands of new redshifts and long-lived particles, and you know, it would be great. I don't have any complaints about that. But I'm not sure we'd have enough information to do that level of analysis yet. We would run the LHC for longer and focus on these things. We might even build a detector or rebuild one of the detectors that's especially good at finding long-lived particles in that case, right? And you have a dedicated detector or sub-detector, which then would pick up much more data with higher luminosity.
So I'm still trying to understand an aspect of this triggering. So
yeah.
If the particle, the V hadron, is moving slowly and then the pion comes out late,
yeah,
and outside the window of event recording for the detector is suppose they, you know, somehow kept the detector on and were looking for these things a little bit delayed, and they saw something strange, a little bit delayed, how important would it be to collect the rest of the events that came promptly associated with the same delayed thing?
I think, so let's take a case. Supposing you have 130 GeV Higgs, and it's decaying to two particles whose masses are 55 GeV, so the betas are fairly small.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and they travel some significant distance before they decay, so the decays are also out in the middle of the detector. I think only the experimentalists can tell you what will happen, and it will be totally different at Atlas and CMS. So,
the answer will be different, you know, what subsystem you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. So the thing I have in mind here, let's suppose you make the Higgs, let's say by vector boson fusion, and you want to trigger, you want to, you know, observe the forward and backward jets in order to know that you had vector boson fusion. Okay, that's a prompt thing. Meanwhile, you don't see any sign of the Higgs decay until, I don't know what, you know.
Probably the next bunch crossing.
Probably the next bunch crossing
probably
or something.
Probably
is there any way you could possibly retain the tagged jet information?
If you trigger on the jets, then you will get, in principle, your event will get the time slice there. You know, some detectors, like electromagnetic or imager, you know, keep 10, 25 nanoseconds type time slice.
Right, but
right, so in principle, you would have this information from this weird stuff at the event. Right now, whether it will go through your reconstruction program the way
you
want.
I think we have we're going to have more time for discussion. I think we should move on because we want to get our introductory talks done. But I think this is great to have this discussion. So let's just get you set up here. What do you have? You have a PC?
Matt, floor here.
Yeah, let's thank Matt. Thank you. Okay, so. Why don't you handle this part of it, because I can plug in.
Right.
Just take this out of the way here. And we have the line. Where did I? What is this? Here's this. You want to put this in?
That's a little bit better. Somehow this one's much better on 160.
You have to do something.
Yeah, don't worry, I know how to do this. Let it come on.
So what do you do today?
Yeah.
Just takes a minute to come. Yeah, they're the shortage of chairs.